the factor of the heat, molecular structure, and the unchanged, unchanged field and molecular structure. That's what I was pointing to.
Okay, I still think that there is a degree of similarity here between spring and magnet. Well, there's a lot of differences, without a doubt. If I'm psychically compressing a spring and releasing it because I am deflecting the steel, it is my guess that an extremely small amount of heat is going to be generated, and with a calorimeter I could measure that amount of heat. However, as long as I'm not pushing the spring to the point of permanent deformation of the steel, as long as I've always used it within its elastic limits, I could push that spring 10,000 times, and in theory it'll come back to the exact same position after 10,000 times, even though some heat is being generated. By the same token, when I'm pushing magnets together, if I'm doing it fast enough and cyclically enough, because I am changing the local magnetic field at the surface of the magnet, because the magnet is not made out of very fine laminations, I am going to be getting some eddy current losses. In other words, I could take, for my analysis, I could take my felt tip pen and draw a very light blue line around the perimeter of the upper surface of the magnet. And I could consider that perimeter a piece of wire. And because I'm changing the magnetic field that goes through the middle of that circle of wire, a current or a voltage is being generated around that perimeter. That current is going through a steel that's got some resistance. Therefore, there's going to be some IR loss, and that's called the eddy current loss phenomena. Very similar to a transformer. Every transformer that doesn't have fine laminations to its core has eddy current losses as you make magnetic field changes for a very similar phenomenon. So I could be losing some energy in the process of cyclically pushing the magnets together. However, at the end of the process...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
At the end of a process, a high-quality magnet could easily come back to the exact same position. And then if you want to analyze, okay, where did the energy loss come from? If I'm doing it fast enough and cyclically enough, I could, in theory, measure the true RMS power that I'm putting into the system on the downstroke. I could keep that separate and measure the true amount of energy that I get back on the upstroke, force versus distance. And if eddy current losses are taking place during that cyclic moving procedure, and I keep track of all of those cycles of downstroke and all of those cycles of upstroke, the difference in those would account for the energy loss if there was one. But the magnetic field itself, when no motion is taking place, even though those two magnets will be pushed apart for the next year or 10 years, it's easy to say, gee, that lower magnet is doing work on the upper magnet. It's easy to say that because the magnetic field is holding them apart and the eye sees nothing in between. But still, if the upper magnet is not moving in vertical position, which would change its potential energy, then no real work is being done by the usual definition of work. Only during the motion process could some energy be lost by hysteresis effects, among some other effects. So it's easy to think that the lower magnet pushing through its magnetic field on the upper magnet and its magnetic field and suspending it 3 inches in space with a certain weight on it through that lever, it's easy to think that continuous work is being done. Not everyone will agree with that, because the usual definition of work is a force applied through a distance. And if no motion is taking place, then there is no distance displacement, and by the usual definition, there isn't work being done. I will admit that...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I will admit that if you take away the magnets, or take away the lower magnet, and substitute a human being there, and you have the human being hold up that upper magnet, with through his muscle power, he supplies the force to hold up that magnet. You now run into a difficult set of definitions. By the usual definition, by the way physics is taught to us, if the human being does not move that upper magnet, he hasn't done work on the magnet. However, because of the way the human being works, yes, his muscles are getting warmer, his joints are being compressed, and he is eating more calories, and he is doing an energy consumption within his body in order to continuously supply that force. Well, that's something going on within this very complicated machine called human being. But on the devices of measurement, the magnet and where it's lifted to some particular position, I think no work has been done. I admit that not everyone's going to agree with that. Let me pass it over to John first and see if he agrees or disagrees with what we've said so far. KC2WGB, the scientist of the Staten Island, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
Dick, thank you for putting up with this protracted experiment. I understand the spring, and I agree with you 100%. There is no work being done, and I don't want to get into the physical body because then you're right. The person is not actually doing work, but the chemical process in his body is doing things with energy. I understand that. But this whole thing is getting... Now, the spring, we can actually measure... This is another thing I need your opinion on. We can look at a spring under compression, and we can see the stress on the extreme fibers. Very easy to do. We can also measure the caloric values and the heat. Does the same process happen to a magnet when we try to force it together? Do we have stress on the extreme fibers just like we would on a spring?
No, so I want to add to that. Well, at first, if there are losses and at the end of it there are no losses observed, then no losses appears to be valid, even though that they were in the process. The second thing, within 24 hours, movement of the Earth due to gravitational and magnetic changes of the field, there is a constant effort to keep these magnets apart. So there is always change, always effort, and I do not necessarily agree that the work is not being done at that point, but you...
Stay on track.
Yeah, we are into a couple of areas of slight or maybe extreme areas of a little bit degree of difficulty in definition of what's going on. In the case of compressing a spring, without a doubt, those outer fibers are being flexed. In theory, with an electron microscope, you could see the flexure of those outer fibers, of the spring during the compression. In the case of a magnet, when you've got two opposing magnetic fields, a pair of north facing each other and a pair of south facing each other, on these horseshoe magnets that are, one of them is tied down to the bench and the other one's on some kind of a track so that it can do nothing but move vertically. And when you push down on that upper magnet, what I think you're asking, John, is are the fibers of either magnet being compressed? In other words, if I push the two magnets together with, let me pick a number, 10 pounds of force, and then if I take the lower magnet and with a non-metallic object, like a very solid chunk of ceramic, and I put it into a compression machine of some kind, and I apply 10 pounds of force to the upper surface of the horseshoe magnet, and because the steel has a certain Young's modulus, in other words, it's going to have a microscopic deflection. By me applying 10 pounds of force to the upper surface of the magnet, I've taken the magnetic steel structure and deflected a little bit. And I could measure that amount of deflections in micro-inches if I got the right kind of instrumentation. And now, if I do it by doing that compression with a second magnet, would I measure the same amount of deflection? And I think the answer is no. You're about to ask why. I told you what I think. I ain't sure on this one.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I ain't sure on this one. And the answer ain't traceable to the Bureau. That magnetic field of that lower horseshoe magnet is something that's generated by way of the grain orientations of the individual microscopic sections of that magnet throughout its whole length of that U shape of that lower horseshoe magnet. So the orientation throughout that U shape of those grain-oriented field, of those microscopic sections and their grain orientation is where the magnetic field is coming from. So therefore, it is my belief that there is a kind of deflection that takes place when you put them together. Microscopic, not significant when it comes to the total amount of energy. As I push those magnets together with your lever mechanism, and if I carefully measured the amount of energy I put into the system in foot-pounds, if you want to use that system of units, on the downstroke, and then I measured the amount of energy that I get back on the upstroke, and I very carefully make those measurements, I think they're going to be extremely close to each other, but if you've got enough accuracy, it's not going to be perfect. And some of that mechanism of imperfection, I think, is eddy current losses, which we've touched on a little bit. Some of it could be, I know that there's still a kind of deflection of the steel, but a different amount. A different amount when I did it with the magnet as opposed to the ceramic rod. And a different distribution throughout the magnet of that deflection. But I think the physical deflection of the magnet, I think, is very microscopic. You're moving the upper magnet toward the lower magnet in inches, and if there's any deflection of the magnet itself, I am guessing it is micro inches. So it could be a tertiary effect, and that is not the major mechanism of a loss if there was one. It is my guess that eddy currents would be a better...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
It's my guess that eddy current losses would be a better candidate for one of the major mechanisms of loss if there was one. But even that loss, I think, is going to be under 1%. Now, I'll admit that instrumentation-wise, it's very difficult to come up with instrumentation that carefully evaluates the foot-pounds of energy put in on the downstroke and keep it separate from the foot-pounds of energy that comes back on the upstroke and separate it from the frictional forces that exist on your track. The frictional forces of your track are another mechanism that has to be accounted for. You're into a moderately difficult procedure here, John. You guys have got you've got quite a challenge here. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, thank you very much. I have a further question, which is what the whole experiment was about, but we've gone beyond our 10 minutes. I'd like to, I'll leave it up to you. We'll pick up the other people who are waiting, and then maybe we can continue this later before the end of the net, if possible.
Yeah, you're very gracious, and thank you. Yeah, we should go on to the other two guys that have signed in. Let's see, the very next one is going to be Glenn, and then Glenn, and then Paul in that order. And I hope we haven't put Paul to sleep. KC2QIQ, Glenn, what would you like to discuss tonight? And have you ever played with magnets, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Good evening, Dick. I'm listening, but I didn't call in for the question. But I guess I'll pass it over to Paul.
Okay, Paul, WS2N. Go ahead with any question you'd like, and anything you want to tell us about space, you've got the floor. You got it, Paul.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, I had a real question tonight, not on the space topic. Recently I put up a 40-meter dipole antenna, half-wave dipole. But in doing it, I was thinking maybe I should go with a thinner wire instead of this 12-gauge wire I normally use. I'm thinking maybe an 18-gauge type of wire. The reason I was thinking of that, I was watching a show called Wonders of the Solar System, and there's a guy on it, and he talks about everything. You think you know everything about everything until he comes up with some of these strange facts. And he was talking about a sphere. He's talking about the difference between Earth and Mars, and you know why Mars gave off so much of its heat, where Earth didn't. And Mars much smaller than Earth. It's probably, you know, half the diameter. And he came up with a statement, if you have a smaller sphere, the ratio between the diameter and the surface of the sphere is much less. If, you know, if it's a smaller sphere than a bigger sphere. And then he went on to new business. So I was thinking about that, and I put together I looked up diameter of a sphere, of the, not the diameter, the area of a sphere. I have a book on that, but it's different than what most people use. Let me drop it. The common one I think everybody uses, area equals 4 pi r squared. And my book, I have an older welding book, has all the different formulas, and I've always used area equals diameter squared times 3.1416. So, you know, it's really area equals diameter squared times pi, and they both come up to with the same answer. So I picked two numbers at random. I took a 10-inch diameter, a 5-inch diameter sphere, and I plugged the numbers into the formula. And I came up with the 10-inch diameter one, I came up with 314.16. I used inches, and it came out to square inches for the surface. And I did that with five-inch diameter sphere. And I came up with 78.54 square inches. Let me drop it. And then I figured out, you know, the ratio. I took the one with the 10-inch diameter one. I took 314.16 and divided that by 10. And I came out with a 31.416 to 1 ratio, roughly 31.5 to 1 ratio. And with the 5-inch diameter sphere, which is half the diameter, I took the 78.54 and divided that by 5. And I got a 15.708 to 1 ratio. Sure enough, there's a big difference between you cut something in half and you have a big difference. There is a big difference in the ratio. So that got me thinking about wires. Because wires are kind of, you know, they're round. It's like a cylinder. So, you know, if you bear with me for 1 second, I'll just go through this, Dick. Let me drop it. I'll go through my reasoning and you can tell me if I'm close to right or if you could blow this out of the water, that would be fine too. My reasoning was, well, let me see if there is any kind of ratio between all the different numbers. Well, I took the circumference of, instead of using the actual diameter of the wires, the 12 gauge and the 18 inch gauge, I just took make-believe wires. I made believe the wire was a diameter of 10 inches and the other wire is a diameter of 5 inches. And what would be the relationship for the circumference? You know, so, if you just take the circumference of this thing, so you take, you know, circumference equals, I write down the diameter times 3.14, and with that, you know, which you get an answer of 31.4 inches on the circumference, roughly three times the diameter of of whatever you're measuring. So I come up with, on a 10-inch diameter, 31.4 inches. On a 5-inch diameter, you come up with 15.7 inches. And if you take the ratio of that, of each one of those, on the 10-inch one, you wind up with a 3.14 to 1 ratio. And again, with the 5-inch, you get a 3.14 to 1 ratio. I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, we're not gaining anything there. Let me drop it. You know, everything would be the same. The idea is which wire would, you know, be stronger, most likely to survive in a wind. So then I went to the area. So I did the area, for a cylinder. And figured, well, let me see how it works out. So I took the area for a 10-inch diameter sphere, cylinder. You know, not including the ends, just the outside part of it. If you do the formula for area, you wind up with I come up with 502.4 square inches on a 10-inch diameter sphere, cylinder. And then with a 5-inch diameter cylinder, you wind up with 251.2 square inches. So again, you do the ratio, and when you take 10 into 502 for the 10-inch diameter cylinder, you wind up with 50.24 to 1, and then you wind up with 20.24 to 1 also with the diameter of the 5-inch diameter cylinder, or in my case, the thickness of this ridiculously big wire. Let me drop it. So I'm not gaining anything there in strength. But then I went to the volume. You say, I take the volume equals pi r squared times the height. So I took a fictitious height of my gigantic wire of a length of 16 inches. So with the 10-inch diameter wire at 16 inches long, I do this whole formula of volume equals pi r squared times the height, and I plug in those numbers, and I come out with 1,256 cubic inches. So then with the 5-inch one, I come up with 314 cubic inches. So if I do the ratio for that, I take the 10-inch diameter wire that's 16 inches long, and I come up with 1,256 over 10, and that equals 125.6 to 1. Let me drop it. But with the 5-inch diameter wire, I come up with 314 cubic inches divided by 5, and I come up with 62.8 to 1. A big difference. It was a 10-inch one, 125 roughly to 1, and with the 5-inch diameter wire, you're getting 62.8 to 1. So there's a big difference there. So I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, take the volume, fill that up with copper, since we're not changing, they're both going to have copper. The weight of the copper will be relatively the same on a 16-inch length of wire, as well as the whole length of the 40-meter dipole. So I'm thinking that by using a smaller wire, I'm going to have a weight rate 62.8 to 1 compared to using a heavier gauge wire, in this case a 10-inch diameter wire, 125.6 to 1. So I don't know. I've figured all this out. I know with the gauges. Let me drop it. I think it's about roughly a 3-to-1 ratio with the, I think 18 gauges, like maybe 1/3 or maybe a little less than 12 gauge wire. And this is all solid wire. I'm not talking about stranded wire, by the way. And by the way, I did put it up there. Made a nice job. In fact, on the ends where I tied it to the eyes, I put for extra strength on the insulation, I put a heat shrink tubing and all of that. And by the way, it's not held up in the center. I have nothing up above my house where I could hold it up in the center. So it's just held between two trees. And I'm thinking it might, support the, it's definitely easy to pull up. I mean, you can tell there's a big difference when you pull it up. It won't sag that much. I think it'll survive the wind better. because of that ratio. I was wondering what you think about this, Dick. I'm sure Mel would have the answer right away. He's put up 10,000 dipoles, so. But back to you, Dick. WS2M.
Okay. If I understand correctly, Paul, let me drop for a long enough time. You're comparing a 14-gauge dipole out of copper wire versus 18-gauge copper wire dipole. Is your dipole being fed at the center or at one end? And what feed line do you intend to use? Let me go there first, Paul. Go ahead.
It's just an RG8U cable. It's being fed at the center. It's halfway, 40-meter dipole. And I'm comparing it to 12-gauge wire, which I had up there forever. And this time around, I'm putting up this, relatively thin, I think it's around 18-gauge wire. And that's the numbers. No ballon. In fact, I'm just using it's PVC with two stainless steel eyes going through. SO239 connector at the bottom, connected to that. I've got wire soldered to that, and then to a little spay connectors, which are bolted to stainless steel nuts on the inside, and the stainless steel nuts on the outside again, spay connectors connected to the each end of the 40-meter dipole. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Fascinating discovery. Investigation. Let me drop long enough. When it comes to a dipole suspended in the trees, and you want the dipole to survive, let's do a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation here, Paul, as to what are the mechanisms of failure. First of all, when the trees, and you've got two individual trees, when they move differentially from each other, they're going to pull on your wire. So how strong is the wire, and when the trees fight you, is a big factor. A second factor is the weight of the wire itself. A third factor is the weight of the transmission line, the RG8, going to the center. Of all the things that create the failure of a dipole, I think the trees moving differentially, if you don't have a spring, is number one. And I've strung dipoles and trees with springs, and I eventually, a year and a half later, have a broken spring, because the spring gets flexed so many times, and it gets flexed beyond the point of linear deformation. It eventually goes into a failure mode. And you can put all kinds of safety mechanisms and ropes around the spring to catch it after it breaks, so the whole antenna doesn't fall down. Or you can use a pulley mechanism on at least one side in order to accommodate the trees that are going to move differentially. So if this is the best of all worlds, I'd like the dipole itself to be very strong, thick wire, so it can survive the tree movement. Second of all, depending on how much I insist on the dipole being held out straight as opposed to being a V-shape because of the weight of the cable in the center, I'm going to be pulling more or less on the wire in order to try to make it straight. In reality, if the dipole looks like a V-shape, within reason, it doesn't hurt, but a lot of people worry about that because the pictures they see in the book show the dipole as a thoroughly flat-out thing parallel to the ground, and they think if it's got a V-shape to it, it's going to stop working. Not true, but people believe that by mistake. And the third thing is the weight of the copper wire itself. Let me drop. And the fourth thing I should have included is the wind resistance. The strength of the wire is a function of its cross-sectional area. If I double the diameter of the wire and I slice it through the middle and smooth it out with a file and look at it, it's got a certain cross-sectional area. That cross-sectional area, that copper is good for a certain number of pounds of tension per square inch. So the number of square inches in cross-section is what determines the strength of the wire. If I double the diameter of the wire, because the area is a function of pi r squared or pi d squared over 4, it's a function of diameter squared or radius squared. It's a function of the square of the gauge of the wire, let's say, the thickness of the wire. If I double the thickness of the wire, the cross-sectional area is 4 times higher. Therefore, by definition, it's got 4 times more strength. But the surface area is a function of the circumference. And the circumference goes up linearly. If I double the diameter of the wire, the circumference doubles. So a fatter piece of wire. If I double the diameter, it's got four times the tensile strength, but only twice the area of wind load. It's got four times more tension to hold up the trees that are pulling apart from each other. It's got four times the tension capability of holding up the coax cable. So from my point of view of the analysis, Paul, the thicker the wire, the better. It makes it stronger. Yes, it requires more force to hold it up. I'm going to give you that one. And it's a little bit more expensive to buy. I'm going to give you that one. But it's stronger and has more survivability. So if it comes to longevity of the dipole, I'm going to go for the thicker wire. On top of that, the thicker wire has a little bit more bandwidth. Not much. Because
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Because when it comes to bandwidth, you have to really make it a pretty large diameter cage-type dipole before you make a significant difference in wavelength of diameter and therefore a substantial difference in bandwidth. So when it comes to a cylindrical object, Paul, you were using as a reference diameter. I think you should have been using as a reference cross-sectional area, because that's where the strength is coming from, versus surface area, which is a linear phenomenon. So the thicker the wire, because area is diameter squared, and surface area, which is wind load, is diameter linear, you come out ahead with fatter wire. Now, there's a lot of advantages in using a very skinny wire, like 30-gauge wire, because you're hiding it and you don't want the landlord to see it. People will do that, but they do it at a risk. You would never use 30-gauge wire between two trees. The trees would snap it immediately if you didn't have some nice long springy devices, bungee cord, springs, or a pulley mechanism. And a pulley mechanism with its friction, I'm not sure it would survive 30-gauge wire. So from my point of view, the thicker the wire, the better, Paul. As you can see, you and I have done a somewhat similar analysis and came up with the opposite conclusions. So you might want to think about this one a little bit more. And I'm going to pass it over to you, and then I'm going to make a comment about spherical objects, because that's something I've looked into, and I've come up with a very, to me, scientifically interesting conclusion. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. And yeah, oh, I've done the pulley with the brick and all of that. And years ago, I used to think, well, pull this thing as hard as I could, make it straight, you know, thinking you could pull the wire straight. And I got that one book that, you could put 10 million pounds of force on it, you'll never get the wire straight. So I gave up with that idea after reading that book. Forget about ever trying to pull the wire perfectly straight. Can't be done. There's always going to be some kind of a sag in the middle. So, I gave up with the brick. It used to be swinging up in the breeze. I had guides on it, you know, dug into the ground so it wouldn't swing every time the wind came by. That was pretty cool. But, I mean, it would still break, and, you know, so I figured, let me try this. You know, it can't hurt, and worse that could happen. If it does break, I'll just, you know, put up I used to use 12-gauge. Maybe I'll use 14-gauge or something next time. I think 12-gauge is overkill. I mean, you really got to pull on these things, on 40 and 80-meter dipoles to even try to straighten it out a little bit. You wind up with some sag. So, but with this, I mean, you know, very little pull. I mean, it was like a joke when I pulled it on one side to pull it straight, you know, more or less straight up. It goes up so easy. So I smoothed out the insulators, you know, with a Dremel tool, and you know, I really did a. I know any kind of sharp edge, it's going to be over. So the shearing problem is probably the main problem with any of these small wires. But I thought I'd give it a shot. I was interested in what, you know, Mel.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We only lost the last couple of seconds of your transmission, Paul. So cylindrical object, so you come out linear, by linear law, when you convert the square law of diameter into cross-sectional area versus linear law of surface area, which is wind load, and you compare square law versus linear, you come out linear. So linear law-wise, thicker wire is better than thinner wire for a dipole. Its strength in wind load and weight of the cable in the middle and pulling of the trees are what you're worried about. And I think those are the major things you're worried about. So that's a cylindrical object. A spherical object, surface area, like you said, is 4 pi r squared, or pi diameter squared. Same, it's almost the same formula. But volume of a spherical object is 4/3 pi r cubed. So volume is a function of radius or diameter cubed. Area is a function of diameter squared. The bottom line of all that is that bigger objects, the volume goes up faster than the area. And if something is cooling off, you've got a hot object and you're going to cool it off, whether it be the Earth or Mars. Because the volume is a function of diameter cubed and area is a function of diameter squared, the bigger volume object has a much longer thermal time constant. It's got more mass to area ratio. Because Mars is half the diameter of Earth, that means it's got, as a ratio, because you're comparing square to cube, you come out with a much longer time constant for the Earth. Let me give you an example of something on Earth that makes it a little easier to understand. For a moment, let's assume that a whale, a very big object, is a cold-blooded animal. And let's assume that my sample whale is swimming around in Florida in the summer.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
My whale is swimming around in Florida where the water temperature is, let me pick a number, 80 degrees Fahrenheit. And my whale decides to swim up to Nova Scotia where the water is 40 degrees Fahrenheit. So he's going from 80 degree water and 40 degree water. Let's assume he swims pretty fast. And he's a cold-blooded animal. And the usual definition of thermal time constant is how long does it take for 67%, or is it 63%, 1 over E, number E, 2.718, 1 over E, I think it's 63%. So 63% of the ultimate temperature change, how long does it take to take place? With the usual insulation of this very large, massive animal called whale, I think the thermal constant, time constant of a whale is close to a week. So in other words, if the whale could swim fast enough, when he goes from Florida to Nova Scotia, his temperature doesn't settle down 63%-wise until a week passes. He's got a very long thermal time constant. That's experiment number one. Let me drop. Experiment number two, I've got a mosquito in my house. And I don't heat my ham room, let's say. And my ham room is at 40 degrees Fahrenheit on a winter day. And I'm heating up the living room, and the living room is at 80 degrees Fahrenheit. So he flies from my living room, where he's nice and hot, and he flies into the ham room. And because the mosquito is such an extremely small animal, if I make a simple assumption that he is a spherical object, his body is a spherical object, in reality his wings have got blood flowing through them, and they've got a lot of area to them, but let's assume that it's only his body we're talking about. His body is so small that because his volume to area ratio is so much in the other direction, he's a very small object, he's got very little volume and a huge surface area by comparison. You study that mosquito and I think you'll come to the conclusion that his thermal time constant is 1 or 2 seconds. So because the animal is small, mosquito, he's got a thermal time constant of a couple of seconds. Because the exact same materials being used in my example of a whale, because he is so big, his thermal time constant is a week. You could say that the whale has to eat enough food in a week to create that amount of heat that he loses in order for him to be in thermal stasis. The mosquito has to eat enough food if he was had to keep his body warm. He has to eat enough food every couple of seconds to maintain his temperature. You now know why you never see any insects in the wintertime. you'll see bigger animals, whales and birds and foxes and whatever, with a whole lot of fur on them, but you see massive animals in the wintertime, yes. You will never see insects in the wintertime. They couldn't eat food fast enough to maintain their body.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
On top of that, I think essentially all insects are cold-blooded animals. They are the thermal temperature of the environment. So there's at least two reasons why you don't see insects in the winter. They have to be the same temperature as the surroundings because they don't heat their body per se. Yeah, a dung beetle does just before he moves, but that's something different. So they would be the same temperature as the environment. In the wintertime, they'd be moving very slow, and they'd have to be consuming food in order to create the energy requirement to maintain life in seconds, and they can't do it in the wintertime. So you end up with some very interesting experiments when you compare the sizes of things. Reynolds numbers also is something very similar when you compare the Queen Mary to a paramecium. You could have a paramecium swimming in the ocean if he was able to swim in salt water, and you look at him under his microscope and you see him moving his little hairs on the outside of his body that propel him, and the instant he stops moving those hairs, he stops moving in that water in about 1 second, maybe even a fraction of a second. In the case of the Queen Mary going through the exact same ocean, the Queen Mary can turn off its power, its motor, and it'll glide for many miles. It'll glide for hours. So, again, you'd be amazed how things that don't scale in size. You'd like to be comparing the hydrodynamics of a paramecium to the Queen Mary. Because of the size differences and the way the Reynolds numbers work, the comparison becomes a little bit difficult. You run into this problem when you build yourself a small wind tunnel and you think you're going to test a particular airfoil. Air doesn't quite scale the way you think it would. So the bottom line of this, Paul, as I see it, is strength-wise, I think you want to use heavier wire. I think you said you've used 10-gauge wire on your dipoles in the past, WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I always use 12-gauge, but I figured, let me try something new. You know, it's no big deal. If it comes down, I'll just, you know, put up 12-gauge or 14-gauge. You know, I just wanted to try this and see how long it lasts and what you thought. When you buy a dipole, you know, you see the dipoles for the sale in a QST. I wonder if anybody knows, what size gauge do they sell you? You know, what do you come home with and what are you stringing up in your trees? I've never noticed that in the ads.
KC2, QAQ is coming.
And I'll bet you it's usually stranded wire. Go ahead, Glenn. Wait for the beep.
I think most of the standard dipoles and G5RVs and everything that you buy out of a box come with a 14-gauge stranded wire. But actually, the real reason I wanted to jump in was just to mention one of the springing ideas that I've used in trees and between houses and trees that seems to work pretty well. Let me let it drop for a second. Basically, how I spring it is I use PVC pole, 5-inch diameter, 12-gauge wire on most of the lower frequency wire antennas that I use. And basically, like to tie it into a tree, I'll take a 10-foot section and basically just rope off the bottom 5 feet and then have the pulley at the top of the 10-foot section. And then this way just, you know, basically put the tie-off rope through the pulley. And this way when you tighten up the dipole, there's quite a bit of flexibility to the PVC, that top 5-foot section. And it will flex around in the wind and just about everything else. And it seems to hold up quite well. It's a K2RIW, K2IQ.
K2KEY, comment.
Yeah, I'm going to be asking you some further questions about this PVC in a minute. Glenn, go ahead, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I have used the same method. I find a PVC as a spring-like, you know, to relieve the movement. Works excellent. I have that. Now, you talk about long, you know, wire runs. I have a dipole for 160, which from the center support, I like center supports on dipole, and then I fan it out. This way I don't have to drag in the center of the coax trying to pull it down or whatever, you know. I find if I put a center support and then go with the dipole from the center out. The 160 meter antenna goes out 125 feet with no supports to the next tree. And in both ways, it's, you know, it's about 265 feet or so in total. And I use number 10 wire, number 10 copper weld. That's what they sell you. It's very strong. Never had it break yet. It's called copper weld stranded wire, Dick, over.
So the individual strands are steel with copper on the outside. And are there seven strands in that wire that's used for the antenna, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Seven strand copper weld wire. Comes in a lot of different gauges. You can get a 10, get a 12, get a 14. And for long runs, I find number 10 best. I have that also for my big loop, which is 275 feet. It's a continuous loop, you know, so it's a lot of wire there because it goes from the shack up to the insulator and then goes 275 feet around the square, comes back to that insulator and goes back down, goes down to the shack, but it drops 35 feet and then goes into the shack. So a lot of wire there, and I find that that never had a break yet, Dick, over.
And if I know you, what I think you did is to take that continuous piece of wire, starting at the shack, it became the right-hand side of the open wire feed with the spacers that you added, it came up to the first insulator of the loop up in the air, went beyond that insulator, went all the way around the perimeter, and then it came back down the left-hand side, one continuous piece all the way of seven-strand copper weld. I bet is what you did with no real junctions anywhere. And roughly, what is the cost of the seven-strand copper weld 8 or 10-gauge wire these days, Mel? Where would you buy it? Roughly, do you think it costs? And how did you suspend it at the four insulators on the four corners of that loop, if it was a four-sided loop? How did you suspend the wire in those areas to keep it slipping through that those insulators? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Out of work. the wire was a pain that time. There was a company that was selling it. I think Radio Works is still handling it now, still selling it. But I bought that wire. Believe it or not, when I bought the copper weld wire, it was for another purpose. The place I bought it from, I never expected to find it there. He had all kinds of wire. For instance, he was selling barbed wire. He was selling guy wire, you know, stranded regular steel cables of all kinds. And I see this stuff there, and I see it's copper well, and I ask him, what the heck is use this for? He says, oh, I don't know. He says, we've got all kinds of wire, and he says, that and that. Bought a roll of this also, a few rolls of this. I only bought one roll, which was, at the time, 1,000 feet. I should have bought more, but it was heavy as all hell. I only bought one roll of number 10. I should have gone back and bought another roll because it's a phenomenally excellent wire. Let me let it drop, and I'll tell you how it's supported. Okay. Now, come out of the shack. Go up 35 feet. There's a pole up on the roof. And at that pole is a pulley with a insulator. In fact, that's where I pull it up to. In other words, to get to that spot. I gotta have pulleys. I have to have pulleys on all the poles. It's just impossible to string this thing up. I went crazy trying to figure out how to get this up. So I go through that up to that insulator. Just go through that insulator there, and I got a tie. Just to hold it in place there, regularly one of these regular black plastic ties, a fairly heavy one, just to sort of clamp it there. Then I go to the next pole that's in the backyard. That's one of these. That's a crank-up pole. That's one of these poles I bought. I spent a lot of money for them. It's actually made. You can put actually antennas on them. You crank the handle, and the pole goes up. The goes down to about 20 some odd feet and then goes up to about 50, I think 50, 55 feet. Then I got another one like that at the other end of the yard that's about 50 feet away from there. Let me let it drop. And that has another insulator, go through that insulator, the same thing, and then go across, and there's another pole now that's mounted up on the chimney, that is bracketed to the chimney, and with that, with those Kindles, and that pole has an insulator on it, and like I say, every one of these have pull-up ropes, and you just go through that insulator, no tie-off. Then I go to the front of the house, there's another pole, I go through that one, then come around, and then there's a tree. Aha, there's my tree. And that's where I have a PVC pipe, and with an insulator. You go through that insulator, now you're heading back towards the insulator that's above the shack. So the only places that it's tied off, you know, in other words, it can move. The wire can move in all the insulators, Dick. The only ones that are tied off is the one right above the shack. That is it, so that the wires stay balanced there, because that's where the homebrew spreaders start, Dick, over.
Interesting. Are your insulators made out of plastic or glass, Mel? Do you have reason to believe the wire ever slides through those insulators? Because if it does, it's making a right angle bend at that point, and any sliding is doing a fairly difficult flexure. And if it was plastic, it would eventually cut through the plastic. Back to you, Mel.
Okay. I thought of that. You know what I'm using for insulators? You would be amazed. Did you ever see these heavy glass insulators that they put up on a, they mount them, they have a screw that's embedded into the ceramic, heavy ceramic insulators, and it's used by the power companies. In other words, that is the strain relief for your drop line that comes from the pole, like, you know, from the pole in my backyard, from Edison pole, they have the drop line. Now, you got to have a strain insulator. It's got a, what is it about, gee, must be about at least a 3/8. Maybe a half-inch nut that's on there. Forget already. And what I did on that nut, I put a nut on there and a hook, and that's where it's pulled up on. But that's the insulator I'm using. Those heavy, what are they made out of, ceramic or glass, over?
Yeah, I think it is a kind of ceramic-like glass. Very tough stuff. Sort of brownish in color. The actual insulator itself, how big is the hole, and does it have a nice rounded corners where the wire goes through the hole? Go ahead.
The reason I selected it, you got it. Sure, it's got a nice curve in there that, you know, doesn't make the wire go at right angles. It actually makes a nice clean curve. And the hole in there, you know, it's big enough for the drop line. Remember, they pull the drop line through there from the pole. They pull through, the drop line, maybe number 6 wire. They pull it through, and they loop it back, and then, you know, you tie it. They tie it. Now that forms that loop there. That's the strain relief before it goes to your, to the house, to the conduit that goes down, you know, the side of the wall to the basement for the house, over.
I'm not sure if they call it the king post or whatever, but that post at the house where the wire goes to, very nice. So, it sounds to me like that 270-foot, 80-meter loop antenna, full-wave loop antenna, for you has been very reliable. You've had it up how many years? Have you ever experienced any failures, Mel? Go ahead.
Oh, it's up there now. I'll bet you 6-7 years up there. Never failure at all. It's strong. I think that wire is strong as all heck. And, I think that wire, I don't know if you ever handled, if you ever get a chance, take a piece of that copper weld wire, and you see that stuff is pre-stretched or whatever, but that is one heck of a strong hunk of wire Dick, you'd think it's almost like guy wire. You know, it's almost like the, you'd think almost like, maybe it is. Maybe it's similar to, for the copper plated. Maybe it's similar to the strands that they use on guy wire, over.
Sounds to me like that stuff is strong enough that as long as you're tying it off high enough in the tree, that I could have a dipole between two trees with that stuff, and the tree itself would be the spring, and the wire would be a steady length, and I might not need any additional spring. Although you do have that tree out front, which is one of your tie points, and you did make an escapement mechanism or a slipping mechanism at that tree, Mel, go ahead.
That's PVC pipe. I got a piece of PVC, pipe that is held to the stalk of the tree with just ties, these big black ties, these heavy ones, and it moves. It's you know, it's a good hefty piece of PVC. I guess it's what is it? An inch and three quarter, I think it was, an inch and three quarter PVC pipe. That stuff really bends. You want to see that? You know, you can really see a nice bow in it. But that bow seems to move back and forth very nicely, and with that pull on it and everything, you know, at first I said that it would break, but you know something? It just provides the right amount of tension. And I used the same method for the 160-meter dipole. That PVC pipe makes the spring, and it bounces back, and it's amazing, Dick, how long that's up there, over.
Therefore, the rope that holds up the loop antenna at the green tree out front, I think it's an evergreen tree, I'm guessing that rope goes up the center of the PVC pipe, at the top of the, and the bottom of the pipe is bound to the tree. The top of the pipe can spring away from the tree a few degrees if it wants to, that's the springiness, and where the hauling up rope exits that PVC pipe, is there a pulley mounted in that area, Mel? Go ahead.
Yes, exactly. I have pulleys on all the poles. Everything has pulleys. In fact, the crank-up poles in the backyard, I don't trust them. I don't even know if they even will come down anymore because I figure that was a lot of hocus-pocus the way that stuff works, you know, with those pulleys and that, the way the pike slips into one another and all that kind of jazz. So I put pulleys up on it, on the top of the poles there, and raised those poles up, the guided and everything, and I said, the heck with it, took the handles off, and that was the end of it. And so if I, when I raised the that corner of the dipole, the loop up, I strictly pull it up with the rope. I bought those pulleys from Radio Works. I mean, these are marine pulleys. They had them on sale, marine pulleys, and the rope that I use is it's a nylon type of a marine rope that's about, it's pretty heavy stuff. It's about at least, I think, a half inch in diameter, Dick, over.
They do sell an ultraviolet protected version of nylon rope, which is black in color. Maybe yours isn't, but that would have a little bit greater longevity. The pulley that's at the top of the PVC pipe, where the haul-up rope goes through the center of the pipe, and then at the top of the pipe it joins that pulley, goes over that pulley. How is that pulley, what diameter is it, and how is it mounted to the top of the PVC pipe? What kind of hardware is at that intersection, Mel? That's one of the stress points that you got to be a little bit careful. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Most definitely. What I did up there, because you've got a problem like that, I got these half-moon plates. Now, the hook goes through the PVC pipe, and you got a nut. It's a quarter 20 hook. Now, to keep that hook from breaking away, you put on a quarter 20 nut on the hook. You then put a plate. It's like a half-moon plate. They use it for, what the heck they use those plates for? Height, something like that. Where the heck? I don't remember where you picked them up. You put those plates. Then You go through that plate, through the PVC pipe. Now, once you go through the PVC pipe, you put another quarter-inch nut, and you tighten it up there. In other words, before you continue through, you put another nut.